I was talking with someone recently who used to be one of the more restless people that I knew. He always had something going on. This is the type of person who makes you feel slightly behind just by existing in the same room as them. And so I asked what he was up to these days. And he said that he had been really focusing hard on protecting his peace. And that he'd done a lot of work on himself. And that he just didn't really have the bandwidth anymore for things that didn't align with his growth. And so I nodded, raising my eyebrows a little because it wasn't really the kind of response that I expected. But later on, I kept thinking about it because something about that conversation felt like I had watched someone hand in their resignation from their own life, and then they framed it as a promotion, which is, that's a choice. But now, I don't mean that as a criticism exactly, because the world that produced this kind of response, I mean, let's admit it, it is legitimately draining. And we're going to get to that later. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, the collapse that we are currently observing, it's real. The whole rigged feeling of everything is real. I mean, we're watching it all happen. It's just that the statement, protecting my peace, it's starting to function in certain conversations the way that like an out-of-office reply functions. You know the one. Technically, it's an answer, but it's also kind of a door. And so you get this distinct impression that nobody's really planning to come back from wherever it is that they went. And so the thing is, from the outside, you can't really tell. And from the inside, apparently, neither can they. Okay, so before I go anywhere near what might sound like a critique of any of this, I want to say something plainly. Now, I do believe that the conditions that produce this are real, as I said. And I think they're probably even worse than the official story admits. So let's go over a few fun statistics, shall we? All right, so for starters, 55% of the workforce in the US is currently experiencing burnout. Now, this was from a survey of over 1,400 full-time employees that was conducted in late 2025. Now, that's full-on burnout, okay? This isn't just being tired and being disappointed in your job and whatnot. Okay, 72% of workers report moderate to high stress, the highest reported in 7 years. And globally, only 20% of employees were engaged at work last year, which means that 80% of the people that are showing up to work every day are just, they're just doing it out of some combination of obligation or fear or just the vague hope that things will eventually make more sense than they currently do. And that's a hell of a lot to ask of a Monday morning, you know? There's this economist named Guy Standing who coined the term precariat, which is a growing class of people who do work that offers no security, no real sense of identity or purpose, and there's no sense that what they're doing connects to anything more than the next paycheck. So, not only are they underpaid, they're unmoored. So they're doing meaningless work for people who don't really care whether they show up or not, in exchange for just enough to keep doing it. There's this interesting book called Brightsided, which was written by Barbara Ehrenreich, where she takes this topic a little further. So how does the US culture respond to all this? Well, it responds by demanding that people feel positive about it. That's right. You will accept your shit sandwich with a smile on your face, you filthy little plebeian. So basically, what happens is the exhaustion and the meaninglessness, those get reframed as personal attitude problems. And so the implication there is that the reason that you're burned out is because of your mindset, not because the system is extracting everything it possibly can from you, or because you're just an expendable, soon to be obsolete tool. And so, when I think about this personally, I find this to be one of the more despicably manipulative tactics that a culture has ever attempted, while somehow still keeping a straight face about it. So the withdrawal didn't make sense. The response was earned. I don't think that's in question here. And this next thing, this is probably something that should make everyone just a little more uncomfortable than it does. So this isn't really, this isn't just a US problem, of course. It isn't even just a Western problem. This is happening independently in different languages, in different cultures. It's happening among people who don't know each other, and yet they've arrived at the same conclusion anyway. So, okay, China has Tang Ping, which roughly translates as lying flat, where this is mostly involves younger workers who are opting out of the I guess the punishing work culture by doing as little as humanly possible. Now, originally, the phrase meant lying flat and getting over the beatings, which is that's a fairly vivid description of what the labor market feels like to the people inside of it. And of course, the Chinese government tried to censor the movement. Which should tell you everything that you need to know about how seriously they took it. And then in Japan, there is the what they call hikikomori. So this is a withdrawal that is it's more comprehensive. It's so complete. You know, it's not just the lying flat version. This is it's like an entire lifestyle. All right, and then there's South Korea, and they have what they call Sampo, which is the they call it the giving up generation. So Sampo basically means giving up three things: dating, marriage, and children. Primarily because full participation in the social contract feels too rigged to even bother with anymore. And one thing in particular that really interests me about all this is that these movements didn't know about each other. They didn't coordinate this, and yet they emerged from completely different cultural context, and they somehow landed in the same place anyway. Which that is not a trend. Trends get started. This got discovered separately by millions of people at about the same time. And then, of course, you know, we have to mention the birth rate, with South Korea leading at only 0.72 children per woman, which is the lowest that's ever been recorded for any country in history since they've been keeping records. And there's also Japan and Italy and Spain, who are all also in free fall. And I would argue that these numbers and the lying flat movement, they're not separate phenomena. They're pretty much the same decision, just they're just being expressed in different data sets. So I guess, you know, you could call this the like the ultimate quiet quit, right? Except nobody's really filing the paperwork. Okay. Let's talk a little about the cultural theorist Mark Fisher. Because he had some great ideas about a phrase that he coined called depressive hedonia. That sounds pleasant, doesn't it? Depressive hedonia. So Fisher discussed this concept in his book, Capitalist Realism, and it stuck with me because it describes something that I've personally recognized anyway. So, depression, it's usually it gets described as something like a crushing presence of numbness, right? But depressive hedonia, that's a little different because it's not really the total absence of pleasure. It's the collapse of wanting anything that requires effort to get. So, what does that mean exactly? Well, basically, what this means is that you can still feel things. You're not completely numb, you know, you're not completely checked out. You still get those little dopamine loops, but you just can't seem to want anything that costs something anymore. You don't want to do anything that really involves taking some risk. That's understandable. Now, Fisher described this as it's just enough pleasure to keep you depressed, which is, I think, that's a pretty accurate description of a certain kind of modern existence that I've noticed. So I guess you could look at this like, you're not quite miserable enough to seek help, right? But you're not satisfied enough to feel okay. You're just in this spot where you're sufficiently numbed to keep going without questioning things too much. Now, this is basically the sweet spot that our modern systems of extraction, they want you to inhabit, obviously. This is like a functionally dysfunctional cycle where you're in this ruminating state of sorts where you keep doubting yourself and questioning yourself and questioning if you're depressed or not. But you just keep grinding away regardless, and you never really resolve this. And Fisher wasn't moralizing about this. He knew this is primarily a societal issue. The system produces this because, the endless, ubiquitous availability of the anesthetizing, frictionless pleasure that we now have, this does something damaging to the capacity for any kind of effortful wanting. And the bottom line is, effortful wanting is a big part of what makes life worth living. But Fisher didn't just pretend it was fine. He knew what was being traded away. And what's being traded away is something that I think it's a little harder to define than energy or ambition. I think it's closer to the sense that there's something out there that is still worth wanting badly enough to risk disappointment over, which, and I say this with some personal familiarity with the condition, this is a harder thing to recover than you might think. Because, well, all right, I think this is where Martin Seligman becomes relevant. Because what Mark Fisher was describing culturally, Martin Seligman was documenting experimentally. And I think the results of this are, well, they're clarifying, let's just put it that way. So Seligman, his learn to helplessness research, it basically showed that when an organism is repeatedly exposed to situations where effort produces no result, it eventually stops trying. No surprise there, right? But it'll even stop trying after the situation changes, even after effort would finally actually work. And unfortunately, the model built on past experience, it remains functional long after the conditions that have built it have changed. So What this means is that when the door to freedom finally does open, the organism doesn't bother to leave. Why? Well, because it learned accurately from everything that came before that trying doesn't matter. And nobody sent a memo when that finally changed. And I think this maps pretty directly onto the comfortable collapse, because the original reasons for stopping, they were real. You know, the system was rigged and the effort didn't pay off in the ways that were promised. So, of course, the withdrawal made complete sense at the time it started, right? But, well, here's the problem. What happens when the conditions shift or even just slightly improve, but the withdrawal just continues anyway? Well, that is the trauma talking. Because the model built on past failure, it stays in place long after it stopped being useful. The damage has been done. Which means that protecting your peace stops being a response to an actual threat. And it just becomes like a habit that outlasts the threat that created it. And then, you know, the more toxic aspects of wellness language arrives to provide a story that makes this ongoing condition feel like it was a choice that you made. Instead of an inherited script. So, the bandwidth and the peace, all of that is doing the work of making the stopping sound like arriving. And this is the comfortable part of the comfortable collapse. The collapse, it happened for good reasons, but the comfort is what makes it hard to notice when those reasons have, I guess, quietly expired. It's insidious like that. I think the thing about the comfortable collapse is it never introduces itself in an honest way. It always seems to come in disguised as relief. So, okay, take for example, let's say you had a friendship that required actual effort to maintain. You know, where you had to initiate and show up and you had to remember things about their life and so forth. But then at some point, you just didn't anymore. And they didn't either. And now it's been, 8 months, and the last message is the thread, and the thread is a meme one of you sent that the other never responded to. Which is, you know, a perfectly dignified ending to a meaningful human relationship. Said no one ever. Or, how about it's some creative thing that you used to do that mattered to you, but it gradually got replaced by you watching other people do creative things on social media. Which is basically, that's like the artistic equivalent of eating photographs of food, right? Not exactly appetizing. And the thing is, these don't feel like losses when they're happening, They feel like something like a simplification, let's say. And I think the simplification can be real, but also it can be what I think progressive numbness feels like from the inside when it's working. This sort of reminds me of something that Rollo May wrote, where he basically said that the reason we feel so empty is because we are terrified of the anxiety that comes with actually owning who we are. I mean, radical self-acceptance is scary. So we play it safe, because playing it safe gives you the appearance of being a responsible adult. I mean, it doesn't look like cowardice. You're in this situation where you make all of these tiny, reasonable choices that they seem wise at the time, right? Until you finally reach a point where you look back and you realize that your life got way smaller than it ever needed to be. And I think the revelation there, I think the thing that distinguishes intentional simplification from the comfortable collapse is whether you still notice what you gave up. There's this book by Jenny Odell called How to Do Nothing, where she talks about this distinction. So what's happening is there's an intentional disengagement, like a form of resistance, okay? And there's a withdrawal in order to re-engage differently. So, all right, but from the inside, one of them is a door that you walk through on purpose, and the other is a door that just it slowly swung shut while you weren't looking, while you were distracted. So, thinking about that friend again, the one from the beginning, I want to be clear that I'm not trying to diagnose him from a distance or anything like that. I don't actually know which one of these he is, or whether the piece is the real thing or the habit that outlasted whatever it was protecting him from. And, maybe he doesn't fully know either. That's sort of the whole problem with this condition. It doesn't exactly come with the label neatly printed on the inside of it. If only it was that simple. So I guess what I keep coming back to is that the world that produced the comfortable collapse, it's not imaginary. And the burnout and the whole rigged game situation and the trying to or trying all the trying that didn't pay off, all of that happened. And it was real. And stopping was, for a while anyway, that was the only sane response available, understandably. But, well, here's the thing. Sane responses sometimes have this ability to outlive the situation that made them sane. And nobody rings a bell when that happens. You don't get a, you don't get pinged or anything. The door just stays open. Well, you sit there, having long since stopped checking whether it is. So I think maybe the best, I guess the best thing you can do at that point is just to check occasionally. And not in some five-step plan kind of way or anything like that. Just, is there something out there that you'd actually risk disappointment for? Is there something that could let you down? I mean, of course there is, right? But my point is there something that's worth it to you? Because, look, here's the reality. Wanting things that can disappoint you is apparently the cost of being fully alive. And it's a cost that apparently a lot of people have stopped paying without noticing the trade. Rest is supposed to be a pause inside a life. It's not supposed to be the whole address. And the people who seem to be actually at peace, this is the real version of peace, not the rebranded kind or whatever. They're usually the ones who stopped wanting things. They are the ones who they found something worth wanting that nobody could sell them a shortcut around. And I don't know, maybe those are the real questions underneath all of this. Not are you doing okay, because everyone's got an answer for that already rehearsed, but what's actually worth living for? What's worth risking something for? Because I do think that there's a version of this whole comfortable collapse thing happening at a societal level too, not just individually or personally. I mean, we're watching whole populations decide that wanting things and caring about things and, being disappointed by things, it's just not worth the cost anymore. And I get it. I understand. I've been there myself. But I keep asking myself, do we really want to live apathetic lives inside what's increasingly an apathetic society? Because I think that's where this road leads if nobody asks the question out loud. And I don't know that playing it safe is the best option for us here. I really don't think it is, in spite of everything that's happening. Now, I don't really know which one my friend is. And I'm not entirely sure which one I am either most days. But I suppose, whatever the case may be, I think this is probably the most transparent and honest place for me to wrap up this talk today. Lots to think about. As always, thanks for listening.